Daniela Stockflet-Menis. Welcome to my podcast. Because everyone has a story, the place to give ordinary people's stories the chance to be shared and preserved. Or stories become the language of connections. Let's enjoy it, connect and relate, because everyone has a story. My guest today is Alan Nguyen, or Alonso, how they call it in South America. He is a U.S. retired senior Foreign Service officer that recently wrote his first book, Andean Adventures. It focuses on his Peace Corps volunteering days in Ecuador, Bolivia, and Peru. He talks about discoveries of cultures, meaning, and purpose in life, how volunteering led to his further travels and career. Conversing with Alan was delightful. He shares the learning he did on his adventures that taught him modesty and humility. He also explains the process of writing his first book. Alan goes into some detail of his belief regarding the value of volunteering and the immense personal rewards it brings. He also shares his discovery and incorporation of the Baha'i faith. We could have spoken for hours. He and his wife currently reside in Fairfax County, Virginia, in the U.S. Let's go and talk to Alan. Enjoy it. Welcome, Alan. Thank you so much for being here. I really, really appreciate it that you're here today to tell us your story.
Thank you for the invitation. It's such a pleasure to get to know you, Daniela, and to have this chance to share it.
Yes, this is wonderful. And I always like to start, how do we know each other?
Well, this has really been a bit serendipitous, I guess is the best word. I participate in a mentoring group with a number of people, aspiring authors, new authors. One of the people there, Gail Berend, voluntarily mentioned that she knew someone who had a podcast and was offering to share that information, because one of the recommendations I'd had in terms of discussing my new book was to start getting out onto podcasts. Helpfully, I was able to reach out to you, and we've met each other through email, through WhatsApp, and now through the medium of Zencastr.
Exactly. And so you live many years in South America, in Central America, and that's why you got that Latin thing that when you don't know somebody and you meet them, you immediately become friends like we are now.
Absolutely. I'm very influenced by that time in Latin America. My wife, who's originally from Peru, sometimes jokes that I'm more of a Peruvian than she is.
Yes, that's funny. So you wrote a book.
I did. And in fact, it was quite the exercise, because this is following a career of what's now been about 40 years working in international development and humanitarian assistance. I had started down this path really just out of college. I went to the University of Chicago in the United States, and I'd always had the vocation of being a Peace Corps volunteer. It was something I knew I needed to do. And my intention was to go off and commit to 2 years of national service as a Peace Corps volunteer, do some good, something I dreamed of from high school. And then my expectation had been I would return to the States after 2 years and then go on to a career in health policy or politics. I was very politically motivated while I was in school. And much to my surprise, I ended up basically staying on and virtually not leaving.
So this book, Andean Adventures.
Andean Adventures, or in Spanish, Aventuras Andinas.
How long did it really take you to write this book?
Well, on the one hand, one could say it took decades, because I first started thinking about this kind of book actually towards the end of my time in Bolivia. And we're talking about 1989, 1990. I conceived of writing a book to tell the story about some magical things that were happening in Bolivia at the time. And I even contracted with a publishing house in the United Kingdom to pull together the book, but I couldn't quite bring myself to closure on it, and I was continuing to work overseas. Then, many years later, in 2010, 2011, I was serving in Iraq in the Sunni Triangle, a rather conflicted area, part of the reconstruction of Iraq following the downfall of Saddam Hussein and the invasion of the Americans. And I thought I would start working on the book there. I even started playing with the software of Amazon in terms of Kindle Create and other things they had for self-publishing. But I still couldn't quite bring myself together. I had written some notes about my experiences in Iraq, but nothing really coalesced. And then, as a result of the pandemic that we've all been subject to last year, I decided to take advantage of this offer I saw. It was either on Facebook or Instagram. Write a book in 30 days. Decided to sign up for it. It wasn't too much money, but actually it was to create this mentoring arrangement by email with a fellow, Joshua Sprague, who sent out an email every day kind of saying what you need to do, step by step by step. It didn't take me 30 days. I found that within about 6 weeks or so, following his process of building an outline, developing the stories, filling in the chapter's sense of the story that I wanted to tell, I was actually able to pull together the book, do the editing and formatting, contract for a cover and some further work on Fiverr.com. And ultimately, it was published on Amazon at the end of August. Because of some demand from Spanish speakers, I decided to go ahead and arrange for a Spanish translation with the help of a young woman in Peru who I found on Fiverr.com. And I was able to publish the Spanish translation by the end of October. So it's been on sale since then, and now we're working on the audio portion of it so we can have an Audible book.
So that sounds fast, and it is a book that I started to read, and I really enjoy it. The beginning is really captivating. It tells you when you were little, how everything about your life in New York. It was like watching a movie. I really enjoyed it, but I can't believe it that you didn't have anything in writing before, that in 6 weeks you wrote all this.
Well, the only thing that I did have some things in writing, I have to confess. The book basically tells a story of the first 15 years of my experiences overseas, in particularly the Andean countries of Ecuador, Bolivia, and then Peru, how I came to get to Ecuador, the preamble of it, as you mentioned, the experiences of my family growing up in New York, experiences in Chicago, and how I moved on to Peace Corps. But I had conserved some notes, particularly from my time as a Peace Corps volunteer trainee and as a Peace Corps volunteer. And so in the chapter dedicated to Ecuador, I include a number of sections in that chapter that involve actually the excerpts from what was essentially the diary of my time as a volunteer. But other than that, I actually pulled together the rest of the book. And we're talking about 275, 280 pages, so it's a fairly substantial book, about 90,000 words over the course of the 2 months or so. And it's the way I view it, it's part of a larger project. In much of my work, I've served as a coach and as a mentor, frequently with young people. And I got the idea that with the pandemic last year, it could be useful to tell the story of how I came to find myself in a life dedicated to voluntary service, humanitarian assistance in different countries. First, in this book, Andean Adventures, talking about my experiences, as I say, in the first 15 years in Ecuador, Bolivia, and Peru, the important things that happened in my life, including ultimately getting to know my wife and the birth of our daughter in Peru. But then I've got projects planned for other stories talking about my experiences in different countries in Africa, in Western Asia, Caribbean as well.
Do you have the end in mind? Do you know exactly why you wanted to write this book?
Well, I wanted to offer a sense of a search of meaning and purpose. In fact, that's the subtitle of the book. The subtitle is An Unexpected Search for Meaning, Purpose, and Discovery Across Three Continents. The sense of that search is not something that I knew at the start I would be pursuing. As I came through a variety of different experiences, some nice and some not so nice, I found a greater understanding of the meaning for my life, the way I should be dedicating my life, the type of life I should be pursuing, what things I should be doing in my life, a sense of purpose, as well as a desire for discovering more about different cultures, different societies around the world, and trying to bridge an understanding between different countries in the world with Americans. The reality is that North America, United States, is often fairly provincial and somewhat less sophisticated in terms of understanding really what goes on in different countries around the world. So I wanted to be able to offer that. I also wanted to offer to young people an appreciation of how an experience like Peace Corps, which is a voluntary act, I found to really give back so much more to me than perhaps the people that I was serving, and how useful that's been to me in terms of being able to approach and understand my life in the United States, my participation as a citizen, the type of public education, development education that I should be undertaking.
And during your time there, do you feel that you made a big difference, especially on the stage that the South American countries are?
I have to speak humbly on my side that I think I got much more out of it than necessarily the people that I worked with did. But I have received wonderful feedback over the years from different people. In fact, some years ago, I was contacted on Facebook by the children of the host family that I initially stayed with in the early 1980s, wanted to share with me anecdotes and stories of how meaningful it had been for them getting to know me. And similarly, I've had contacts and communications like that from people that I worked with in Nicaragua, in Bolivia, in Angola, and South Africa over the years, and who have let me know at different times, at different moments, what the intersection of our lives came to mean for them.
That's wonderful. That's very rewarding to hear those feedbacks.
It's very gratifying. In Andean Adventures, I do share with the reader an understanding about this really was a learning adventure, and one that taught me much more modesty of and humility about the limits of what I knew and what I didn't know, how it served also as a catalyst for me to drive forward and get to know so much more about the world. I've lived and worked overseas long-term in probably about 11 countries and visited nearly 50 others in a career that's covered about four decades.
Yes, sounded so interesting. The other volunteers that you work with, do you feel that they were as lucky? Do you still in touch with them?
Yes, I'm still in touch with a number of them. In fact, I have the pleasure and honor of serving on the board of directors of a non-governmental organization in the United States called Hunger Relief International. It has its headquarters in Oklahoma, and it was actually founded about 10 or 12 years ago by someone who is also a rural public health Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador around the same time that I was. Rachel has dedicated her life, found a number of different vocations and experiences in her life, similar in some ways, but different from also my own. I've known others over the years who have dedicated their lives to other sorts of service opportunities, but there haven't been quite as many, at least from my cohort of Peace Corps Ecuador volunteers, who went on to take this experience of service to the degree that I did.
Great. And Alan, what happens when you live in so many countries? Which place can you call home? It's so hard sometimes when one is a mixture of different cultures to adapt to one specific culture. So how have you managed to do that?
Well, I often receive the kind of question related to what you just asked in terms of what's your favorite country? That question, along with some of what you've asked, is a little difficult to really clarify because each of the countries that we came to live in have been meaningful and significant to us in different ways, both difficult countries as well as comfortable countries. Ecuador, which is the first country I went to live in overseas, leaving the United States, was very significant for me because I spent my first 5 years overseas living in Ecuador, and I came to know the country up and down, between the coastal part of the country, the Andean mountains, and even the Amazonian rainforest leading down to the tributaries of the Amazon. It meant a lot to me. Bolivia, where I spent the subsequent 5 years, also came to have a great deal of meaning for me in terms of professional purposes as well as spiritual purposes, spiritual search, getting to know about the Baha'i community. South Africa, where we lived most recently, about 3 years, has a special resonance for us because it was a country that we visited multiple times when we lived elsewhere in Africa in somewhat more difficult countries, places like Angola and Nigeria, where going to South Africa was really a place for R&R, really rest and recuperation. But living in South Africa for 3 years from the end of 2014 to the beginning of 2018 was just a magical experience because South Africa itself is such a constellation of different cultures. Iraq in Salah ad-Din province at a time of great uncertainty and violent extremism, the beginning of the threat of ISIS that was coming across from the Syrian border into Iraq. That also is a country where I came to have some very important friends and relationships and came to really appreciate the wonderful hospitality of the Arab people there.
But the fact that you have been to so many different countries and seen so many cultures, is it easy to go back to the States in Virginia and adapt totally to be who you were before?
Well, it's not easy at all. Particularly coming back to the United States under the regime of the previous administration here in the United States, it was very, very painful. The amount of political and social polarization, the division that has come to exist in the United States. Living in this country, while there is beauty and there are friends and there are things that we can appreciate, it's also very much that of being strangers in a strange land. I think it's important to look for ways of building understanding and familiarity with different cultures, not just in languages, but also understanding different mores and different practices. And I was lucky, really, even before my time in Peace Corps, I was exposed to that as an early lesson in high school. I tell the story in my book, in the chapter talking about my experiences in Stuyvesant High School in New York, how I came to part of a freshman or sophomore year project, getting to know different countries. I was assigned the country of Kenya, and I made contact with the United Nations mission of Kenya and became virtually adopted by them during that year in high school. Got to have early on a sense of real attachment to sorts of things that were important to Kenyans in terms of their history and culture.
So how many languages did you speak?
Some would say not enough, or you still have more to do in terms of gaining your English fluency. But realistically, I have more fluency between English, Spanish, and Portuguese. I knew Hebrew as a boy, forgotten much of it. I can still kind of read it a little bit. I learned a little bit of what the U.S. Army used to call Iraqi military Arabic, which is kind of a simplified Arabic, sort of basic expressions and greetings and the like when I was serving in Iraq. In terms of tribal languages, when I was in Ecuador, I actually picked up for a period of time Quechua or Quechua, which is the language of the Incas, because I was working in a number of communities with indigenous Quechua-speaking populations. I can still remember things like Imashutikanki, what's your name? To sometimes my wife and I, if we want to say some things and we don't want the people around us to understand, we'll use a word in Quechua rather than in Spanish or English.
Secret language, huh? That's wonderful. That sounds so interesting because people usually say, well, I speak English, I speak Spanish, but you have gotten different ones that are unusual and fascinating.
And the reality is, unfortunately, Americans don't tend to embrace foreign languages.
Mm. Yes, that could be. And so going back inside this book, you said that is the searching for meaning, purpose, discovered across three countries. What is the mystical part there? I mean, I can understand that because you were in countries that has a lot of indigenous people, that perhaps you had an amazing experience or something different from what you're used to.
Well, that's certainly true, particularly in Ecuador and Bolivia. In Ecuador, my host family took me early on in my Peace Corps service to a brujo, a curandero, basically an indigenous healer, you might say a shaman, who proceeded to tell me all sorts of fantastical stories about how the Ecuadorians were actually descended from a certain warrior tribe of Indians who had been colonized by the Chinese, who had traveled across the Pacific over a period of thousands of years and who had migrated to the Guayas Peninsula in Ecuador. And he proceeded to talk to me about different mystical stories, different parapsychological practices and the likes. Those sorts of experiences really blew my mind. I came to know the Colorado Indians that live in the area of Santo Domingo in Ecuador, and they use a special red paste, the achiote paste, in which they kind of make a red umbrella hat for their heads. They are also very famous medicine men and use a variety of herbs, including ayahuasca, which I came to sample from them and in the Amazon. Ayahuasca is like a blood vine. It comes out as a red sap and doesn't leave you very happy afterwards, but it can lead to certain mystical experiences on the par with psilocybin, magic mushrooms kinds of experiences. I came to know a variety of spiritual practices in Bolivia, came to know people of a variety of different religious faiths. In fact, in Ecuador, I tell the story about how the folks at the USAID mission in Quito, connected with the US Embassy, of course, asked me to take a group of community promoters from one part of Ecuador up to Otavalo, north of Quito, the capital of Ecuador, and to visit Radio Baha'i, which I knew nothing about the Baha'i before that point, but I came to learn that they were world-embracing religious community around the world. They were actually operating a series of very creative educational, radio education, social, and economic development projects in a number of countries in Latin America, and in fact, a radio station in the Black Belt of rural South Carolina, and how I came to appreciate the message of human development, of improvement, of spiritual values and enlightenment from them, not because of any sort of missionary proselytizing, because the Baha'is don't have missionaries, they don't proselytize in that way, but simply from the example, as well as from the teachings within the writings, the sort of spiritual and social principles that they espouse. I came to be familiar with a university that was founded by the Baha'is in the Bolivia eastern part of the country, Universidad Nur, and ultimately made the decision myself to join the Baha'i community as a religious community, in addition to still retaining my Judaism, but also following many of these Baha'i principles that I came to appreciate and believe in, and seeing how they could serve as a key to understanding, in a professional sense, how best to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of our social and development projects. I've written about and spoken previously in other venues the whole concept of spiritual values and development. And then I mean that ecumenical sort of way, because I don't think any religion has a monopoly by any means in terms of spiritual values, but how some of the most successful development projects can be those that make an appeal and try to elucidate out of the people the sorts of spiritual values that are important that they connect to, so that they value the kind of contribution that they need to do in terms of investing in their children, investing in their families, investing in their communities, and in their country.
It is very interesting, and I liked to hear that you had experiences with the indigenous of the area, that you found your own calling for a different belief. However, it seems like you have adopted your own kind of religion by taking the good things of the ones that you already knew.
That reflects a Baha'i principle of what's known as independent investigation of the truth. Really, the fact that in a community like the Baha'i community, there is no clergy. You don't have priests or nuns serving as intermediaries between you and permeates the universe. It really is up to you through reading and prayer and meditation, as well as in your own life, how to find expression through work. Work really being also an important form of worship, you might say. And in this case, the sort of work that I followed, the profession that I followed, has really been guided by viewing this as a more enlightened form of worship rather than a worship of ritual and rites and practices, really a worship in terms of looking for ways of trying to contribute to and make an impact in the life of others. I think it's inevitable when you pursue those sorts of adventures that you can find your lives enriched ever so much more valuable. You can't just look at things as a glass half full kind of thing or with rose-tinted glasses to mix a bunch of metaphors, because we certainly have gone through our challenges and difficulties. It hasn't been a cakewalk. I have been in situations, my family has been in situations where we came into unexpected dangers. We faced that in Nigeria. My wife came up close to situations that we'd rather not have happened in terms of the Nigerian police and the corruption that you can sometimes feel even coming across to diplomats that are serving overseas. And in my work in Nigeria, I found myself traveling often to the northern part of the country, the Muslim north, and coming up really with the Malam, the Muslim clerics, and trying to find ways of communicating a message that they could understand about how even within the Quran, the Muslim teachings, the importance of the education of women, the education of children, the health and well-being of women are important values that should not be neglected within a true Muslim community that is being faithful to the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. And how I found with the receptivity that I was able to convey to people a really a very effective message. And it was actually a very funny and remarkable story. A Jewish guy espousing the Baha'i faith, an American, going up to the Muslim North, meeting with some of the Nigerian leaders, clerical leaders and political leaders who had blocked polio vaccination because of a misunderstanding of Muslim beliefs, and how I was able to build bridges, not walls, not barriers, but bridges, really, to mutual understanding. So I showed the respect to the spiritual underpinnings that they had as Muslims, as well as values that the people living in the north, the Fulani people, who are the indigenous across not only Nigeria, but much of West Africa, the sorts of things that they could understand and that could help them better appreciate the need for investment in health and education.
That is beautiful. I'm so glad that you were able to do that. And also in chapter 6, I hear that your sister has a completely different religious as well as you and the original one of the Judaism.
Well, that's true. I mean, we were brought up Jewish. I began my own sort of spiritual search sometime in the early 1980s in Ecuador and Bolivia, and I came to embrace the Baha'i faith in 1985 in Bolivia, and simultaneously, she became an evangelical Christian back in Brooklyn, New York. She found, for different reasons, that Judaism was no longer appealing to her, and she became closer and closer to a group of Marianist evangelical Christians. And that initially had some challenges because at that time there were messages at some of the churches that she was involved in that were condemning, in fact, the Baha'i faith. And around that time there were billboards in the Pacific Northwest, Washington State, Oregon State, you know, John Birch country in the United States, south of Vancouver, claiming that the two greatest dangers to the American way of life were world communism and the United Nations. And sometimes they would substitute in the Baha'i faith for the United Nations. My sister, though, and I, however, have kept a very close relationship over the years, and she's come to respect and appreciate the sorts of things that I believe in. It hasn't stopped her from sometimes making at least a cursory effort in terms of evangelizing me a little bit. Kind of have to patiently point out to her that, look, when I became Baha'i, it's actually part of the teachings of the Baha'i faith that you come to appreciate the divinity, not only of the founders of all the Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but also the roots of Zoroastrianism, the Hindu faith, Buddhism, as well as other revealed religions. And in fact, what I have found has a very appealing message to different Christian friends in terms of understanding the Baha'i faith, is this appreciation that every culture that develops across the world comes to have its own manifestation of God, its own prophet. And that prophet comes with a body of religious teachings with the same light. It's essentially the same spiritual message, but it is wrapped up with, you could say, a lampshade or a protection, an outside chrysalis of sorts, of a different cultural basis. And so for some parts of the world, it's easier to understand spiritual belief, perhaps from a Jewish point of view. In some parts of the world, it's much easier to understand it from a Christian point of view. In others, a Muslim point of view. And the Baha'i faith is only the most recent of these world religions that come and teach the same sort of message. And it offers a message that really is intending to be world-embracing, really serving as a guide path, a guidepost towards a kind of building of a planetary civilization, not just now in the 20th and the 21st centuries, but really across the next 1,000 years. Now, for some people, that may sound like total hokum and unbelievable, but for those of us that are interested in terms of trying to find a way of connecting this concept of evolution to also the idea of spiritual evolution and cultural evolution, it shows you that there is not only biological evolution, but in fact, the Earth and humanity, despite all of the terrible things that we saw in the 20th century and over many hundreds of years, nevertheless, we are on a positive trajectory that ultimately will lead us to greater unity. Whatever the faith that you want to profess, but it will ultimately have to lead to a world where there will be this bringing together of all of the countries of the world, really building in a planetary civilization and hopefully expanding out from here. We have Elon Musk, of course, and Jeff Bezos and others, Sir Richard Branson, determined to make us a multi-planet civilization, looking to other planets as well as space habitats and the like. And who knows what kind of world we'll live in future centuries. But certainly the Baha'i faith sends a very optimistic message in that direction. And that coincides with my own appreciation and understanding of life in terms of trying to look at things very much from an optimistic, positivistic point of view.
Yes, and I'm glad that you and your sister get along, because religious and politics can break families and friendship. It's good that you have a respect.
It's true. It's true.
And I want to go back to your degree. I know that you didn't finish your degree and you left the States before you finished your degree. But then afterwards, very unusual, I believe, that one of the professors at the university contacted you to see if you wanted to finish it.
That's true. I'm very straightforward and honest in terms of telling the story in the book. And hopefully that can be something of an inspiration for others who found themselves in situations where incompletes might have stymied them in terms of furthering their university education. In my own experiences, I had allowed, during the 4 years of college at the University of Chicago, I'd allowed myself to get distracted between politics and a number of other things to have a number of incompletes, so that by the time I finished my 4th year, I received word just before graduation that, oh, sorry, you have so many incompletes, you're not going to be able to graduate with your class. It really left me very frustrated in terms of what to do. I was already scheduled to leave for Peace Corps Ecuador at the end of that summer in 1980. So I went off for years, was serving in different capacities in Ecuador and Bolivia. And then some years later, I was in Peru, and I was coming to the end of my contract as a project coordinator with the USAID mission in Peru, when it was discovered at that point, when they had to renew my contract, that in fact I had incompletes, and I had not quite finished my university degree. And that blocked them from being able to renew my contract. And it was earth-shattering for me. I did recover in terms of being able to then move on to other adventures and experiences. Found myself procrastinating, and I felt lost. I felt myself cut off in terms of knowing what to do, in terms of being able to deal with my degree. And then really out of the blue, I got a message from the Dean of Students at the University of Chicago, Lorna P. Strauss. She was still the Dean of Students as she had been when I had attended the school some 18 years before. And she reached out to me and she said, "You know, Alan, our records show that you only need 3 courses to get your degree. Now, with the opportunities of doing things online, wherever you are in the world, you know, this was the late 90s already, 1997, you could easily take 3 elective classes, have them send us the grades from those 3 elective classes, and then we'll be happy to issue your degree." And of course, that made me feel, on the one hand, kind of like an idiot in terms of not having tried to do this so many years before. But I got my act together, and of course, my wife pushed me to do so. And over a period of a few months, really, I took several online classes, then managed to get my bachelor's degree, and then received the following year an experiential master's degree in public health, reflecting really my CV, my long years of public health in Latin America.
So I'm asking this question because education in North America is not free. In South America, you do have the option. Many countries in Europe have also the option of having free education. And I believe that everybody should have free education. Students here, they finish a degree, they end with an enormous debt. Do you think that it's important to finish a degree?
You raise a very important point that's really resonating with the politics here as well at this time. You have to look very seriously at really what's the payback in terms of taking on that kind of debt and the value of education. I think pursuing a higher education is important. But from not only my experiences, but the experiences of my daughter and the kind of debt that we ended up assuming as parents, I think if we had to do it over again, I would have strongly encouraged her to look for public options in terms of public universities, particularly for the first couple of years, but maybe even for the full undergraduate education. Because I think studies are showing there isn't really a return. If you are caught in the trap of having to take out loans for tens of thousands of dollars or more each year, it's almost never going to be possible to pay that back. You aren't going to get the kind of necessarily favor in terms of your professional growth, the job that you pursue that will justify that enormous price tag. I think we've got to find ways as a society to dial that back down, and perhaps people refusing to take on that debt, putting pressure on the universities, particularly the private universities, and look to the community colleges and the 4-year public universities as ways to try to mitigate that a bit, at least until we can do something about it. When I went to school, tuition cost at the University of Chicago about $7,000 a year. Now, admittedly, that was in the late 1970s. But if we were to translate that into 2020 dollars, I think that $7,000 would be the equivalent of maybe about $20,000. Certainly nothing to justify a price tag of $50,000 or $60,000 at some of the higher priced universities. You know, all of that is particularly true in the States. You mentioned Latin America and other countries. I think young people in those countries face other challenges as well, because unfortunately, some universities might not cost that much if you are able to get in on the basis of exams. Those that are unable to qualify for these exams and the very limited number of spaces in these exclusive universities may end up being relatively cheaper, find themselves also having to pay for private universities, really taking on a burden. Admittedly, the burden is far smaller. We need some disruptors like Elon Musk and others really find ways to disrupt the traditional model for university education. And I try to tell this a little bit in the book, but I think a university education is only part of what young people need. They need a service experience. Now, whether it's a year in the military like they do in Israel, or 2, 3, or 4 years in national service, as it may be in Canada or perhaps other countries, I think that service experience, where you can basically pay back the cost of your education, is something that is very helpful. It enables you to grow as a person. It enables you to expand understanding. It enables you to break down the barriers, perhaps, between different ethnic groups, different regional groups, rather than remaining always close in, perhaps with what you're comfortable, perhaps putting you in situations in which you're a little less comfortable. And so you're forced to grow and you're forced to really expand your understanding. And I think that's something that as societies, we need to look at, because it's something immensely invaluable for our development as a people, not only in terms of our professional career, but also in terms of having a mature outlook in terms of being able to approach life experiences later on by having to undertake that kind of national service, be it a year, 2 years, or more.
Yeah, that's true. I'm glad you're giving me that point of view. Wonderful. Is there anything else that you would like to share?
Would like to remind our listeners the website enableennoble.net and to take a look at the reviews and the description of Andean Adventures, either on the website or on Amazon. I hope to have other adventures coming up over the course of the next 6 months, telling the story of experiences elsewhere in the world, as well as talking a bit about what I've learned over the years in terms of leadership. Really, what is effective leadership, effective and meaningful way in terms of being able to develop, manage, and lead teams in different endeavors. That's been something I've been able to come to learn from, both from mistakes as well as from training and other experiences over the course of my career.
Yes, it seems that we are going to be seeing a lot more of books and projects from you because you have a lot to share and to offer.
Thank you very much. I appreciate again, Daniela, this opportunity in terms of being able to share a bit of my story and talk about the book.
No, the pleasure was mine as well, because first, I got a new book. And secondly, it was just amazing to get to know you and see all the things that you have experienced. So thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
This is Daniela Stockfleth-Menis, and you were listening to Because Everyone Has a Story. I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and I hope you enjoyed all the episodes that I put out. If you have, please take 5 seconds right now and think of somebody in your life that may enjoy what you just heard, or somebody that has a story to be shared and preserved. When you think of that person, shoot them a text with the link of the podcast. This will allow me to keep doing what I love even more and take the message further. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. Hasta pronto.